The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It was the worst month of the year so far. In fact, the first month in 2019 that the markets are in the red. And now, introducing
Terrence
on Mexico. And our guest today, Howard Silverblatt, senior analyst with S&P Dow Jones Indices. All this and much more on episode number 614 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there, this is Andrew Horowitz, and I am your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Glad that you join me today. Glad that you join me each and every week as we go through the financial and market and investments and just education and information from a whole host of great guests. And here it is. May is over. And I guess the whole sell in May and go away was the right call if anybody had applied that old adage. But, you know, the problem is that that doesn't always work. You know, the fact of the matter is that so many times we have seen that the idea that, yeah, go and sell in May. You know, once you know these things, they don't always make sense. They don't always work out the way that you expect them to. But it was really, and the idea was from years ago in particular, where the summertime was starting to get there. Memorial Day was, you know, it happened. And all of a sudden, traders were getting off the desk, going out to their trading headquarters and vacation homes elsewhere, and volume would dry up because really they weren't at their main desk. You know, they were going on vacation. They were doing things that they would do in the summer. And basically it was time to play. In New York, when I lived there, basically no Fridays. You didn't work Fridays. And then in the summertime, what would happen is that you would maybe even take off Thursday, go out to the Hamptons, go out to a vacation house somewhere, or just take an elongated time because, you know, the winter you're cooped up, you're stuck. And it's not like that anymore ever since we've had all of the ability to access machines from anywhere. So I think that was a big part of the whole idea of sell in May and go away, where volumes would dry up into the summers. But again, things change. But markets basically were doing pretty well this year until the beginning of May, when all of a sudden the idea that the trade deal with China was going to be ripped up, thrown away, no longer meaningful. We're going to scrap this. We'll see what happens, President Trump said. And then that started the tumble. That started to get things rolling. And then on top of that, there was a flight to safety into bonds. And bonds all of a sudden started to rise very dramatically. And now we are on the heels of that, on the concern that we are entering into a full-blown trade war with China. We get this random tweet on Thursday evening this week from President Trump, as I call it, tariff by tweet, that we're now going to be taxing or tariffing Mexico on all the products that are imported into the United States at 5% starting June 10th. Now, is this a negotiation tactic or some kind of bullying? Or I don't know what it is, but the latest move on these tariffs is just getting things absolutely crazy because we're starting to worry. You know, are we going to have a deal with China? Are we going to all of a sudden start a global trade war? Because don't forget, on top of this, we're still pending on tariffs on automobiles and other products from Europe. That was postponed for 6 months recently. And now that President Trump is absolutely convinced that tariffs are a good thing for our country because it brings in billions of dollars paid by the other country that we're tariffing, which is not the case. They get hurt, of course. They will pay in a different way. But the tariffs are paid on the companies that are essentially, well, it's two sides, but we're going to pay for it as consumers. That's how it ends up. I had this big debate with Frank Curzio recently. He was, you know, saying all this about, you know, China. We need to push them into, you know, protecting and us protecting our intellectual property. But now here we are. We're all of a sudden saying, you know what? Now Mexico hey, you know what? We don't like that you're not doing enough for immigration, and we're going to start taxing your products, your imports into our country, the exports or the imports, however you want to look at it, into the United States. This is a tactic that we're going to use religiously. And President Trump is putting his foot down and proclaimed himself, of course, the tariff man. So where does this all go? I mean, what's the potential outcome from all this, and how does it all, you know, get filtered through into the economy? That's a big question. We all get hurt by this, and we're going to see it in prices. I am telling you, we're going to see it in prices. Inflation is going to start ticking up dramatically the longer these tariffs are put in place, and if, in fact, we start escalating from 5% to 10%, like we did with China, up to 25%, and then possibly another tranche at 25% at $300 billion. So basically taxing and tariffing all of the goods that come in from China, taxing and tariffing the goods that come in from Mexico, putting some taxes and tariffs on goods that come in from Europe. What? I mean, how does this not impact pricing? This is something that you really need to keep on your radar and make sure that you don't see any crazy numbers, because what's going to happen is if the economy, we start getting stagflation, we start seeing increasing prices at the same time markets rolling over, there's not a lot that the Fed can do. Because really, what's going to happen? They're going to be looking at this whole area of their mandate of jobs, price stability, as well as inflation and prices, and be stuck in a corner. They've already put the hammer down on rates, and we saw what happened there, right? The two-year rate is now sub 2%. The two-year treasury, the yield on it, is sub 2%. That's unbelievable. The 10-year is at 2.16% at the end of the week. This was a massive, massive move lower. Yields from the beginning of the year to where we are now, oh my, have you seen a chart? Have you looked at the yield curve? Yes, folks, we have inversion. We've had it, kind of got a little bit resolved for a little while there. But if you look at the belly of the yield curve right now, it is substantially lower on, we'll call it the two-year to the 10-year. 10-year hasn't fully inverted yet, but it bows down compared to where it is on the short side. So is that going to force the Fed to possibly cut rates to make sure the yield curve goes back to quote-unquote normal? Or if they do cut rates, is it going to bring down the belly even further? And by doing so, not good for the economy, folks. This inversion process is not good. It's not good for banks. It's not good for borrowing. It's not good for lending. It's not good for expansion. It is not good for the economy. That's why when you look at where we were historically and why you hear that, well, when the twos, tens invert, it is the potential for a recession in about a year out and many time and time again, and it's proven itself to be true. The problem is that when a yield curve inverts, it's not normal, and we are not anywhere near normal at this point. So far away from normal, it's ridiculous. I mean, the fact of the matter is when you look at the yield curve right now and you look at where it is in terms of where we were, let's say, just 6 months ago, the problem is that you have this unnatural view of where it is, because it should be sloping higher from left to right, not sloping a little bit higher, dropping down, and then coming back. So keep an eye on this. We talked about this a bit this week on Friday's pre-market rundown. I do that through Trigger Charts, and each and every Friday, we have a live webinar, and you can join us. Go over to triggercharts.com or look at the show notes for this episode. At 9 o'clock in the morning, we do a quick 30-minute rundown of what's going on. So next week, we have some economics to look at. This week, we saw that GDP came in at 3.1%, a little bit lower than the first estimate. About 0.6% was made up of inventory, so that's still telling us this pull forward or this front loading is still in play. Next week, we're going to look at ISM manufacturing, non-manufacturing. That will be key to look at. And I would think that we're going to see a slowdown there. China's been slowing. ISM numbers in Europe are just awful. Europe looks like it's about to go into recession. So let's keep an eye on that. and see if we can keep that unemployment rate at 3.6% where we saw it now. Anyway, that's it for me right now on this. I want to get to my guest because I really want to pick his brain on a variety of things. So let's get right to that. And our guest today is Howard Silverblatt. He hasn't been with us for some time, but he's a regular guest. He's with S&P Dow Jones Indices, and he's a senior index analyst and has been there for quite a time. Howard, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Watching the market, having fun, watching interest rates.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, it's interesting. I just to put this in perspective, because I think I just looked this up today, but you've been there a long time. As a matter of fact, I think you go back to being at this firm since 1977.
Yeah. I'm in my 43rd year and still on probation.
And you're only 48 years old. That's the amazing thing.
Jack, Benny, and I were born together.
So, you know, I find it interesting because back when it wasn't the Dow Jones, S&P Dow Jones Industries, indices and all that, it was separate and then they combined and all that. And
yes.
You were telling me a story once. You were telling me a story about when you first started, there are only two stocks that were at $100.
For that month in May 1977, it was the S&P 500. It broke 100 that month, and of course we're pointing at the 2780 range now. But the other stock was Berkshire Hathaway, and that's before they created the baby. So Berkshire Hathaway, 1987, $100 a share. It's now 299,400.
Wow!
I think Warren did better than all of us.
Yeah, it seems that way. So I have a lot of questions because you're the keeper of the information. You know, you want to find out information about what's going on with regard to the internals, the fundamentals, the various features, all the important things related to these various indices. You have that information all the time. I know you keep a lot of spreadsheets. You send me several of those that you update on a regular basis. And one of the things that I want to talk to you about was some of the trends that you're seeing now. But, you know, in terms of, we just finished earnings season, right? So give us a quick scorecard of what you saw this earnings season.
This earnings season in Q1 was similar to Q4. The estimates were lowered significantly, and then we beat them. Marvelous situation. Specifically for Q1, they were lowered about 7.1% from the beginning of the year until it started in September. Then we came and we beat it with a 3% number. So we were still lower than the original estimates, but it's all about expectations. So the bottom line is 72.6% of the issues beat the lowered estimates. And we considered that a victory. And April did well. We closed that month, making a new high and a tick off the new high, of course. So earnings came through decently. Sales were up about 5.8% year over year. They were down from the fourth quarter, but that's a typical situation because of the holiday seasons. So sales moved on. Margins obviously dropped down. Bottom line is that earnings were good. Cash flow was good. Companies, tax rates, we don't have the first quarter number yet, but in general, last year dropped to a little bit under 19% from for 2018, from 2017's was 25.5%. I should have such a tax rate.
Yeah.
So they made a lot more of what they kept. So earnings were good. Were they as good as we wanted them to be? No. Second quarter is expected to do also about a 4 or 5%. The big question is going to be the second half and trade.
Right. Because, you know, one of the things that I find interesting is that we saw such a really nice uptick in markets due to the fact that we had this beautiful gift, the tax benefits of what we saw. And that obviously was then translated into better margins for a while. And it was translated into dropping down to the bottom line, overnight, right? And this was all good. There's no question about that. The one thing that I've been watching, of course, is revenues. You know, what's going to happen with revenues? And as we get further along, you know, if revenues start to slow, well, we don't get as much benefit from the taxes. They're not going away, but on a comp basis, right? But what you're saying is that, yeah, it was not as good as expected. We expected somewhere between 0 to 5% growth for the first quarter. Second quarter, you still think it's going to be your estimates around 5%?
5% year over year
right.
at this point in time. Second quarter is holding up mostly well. Again, third and fourth quarter is the concern right now. Anything that happens in regards to trade or interest rates is going to take a little while to seep in. We're already, almost two-thirds of the way through the quarter on there. And most of the guidance has been positive for that point. Companies usually like to get ahead of bad news, and we haven't had many of those as of yet, although we've had longer-term concerns and negative guidance on the chips, obviously, and the retailer department stores. I mean, they've been getting plummeted at this situation. I mean, and Abercrombie this morning, Kohl's last week, they're taking somewhat of a beating. But the earnings overall and the sales, again, through the first quarter held up. Second quarter looks like they'll hold up at this point.
So is a big problem for retail right now, do you think? Is it the combination of a stronger U.S. currency that could be a problem, as well as the fact that you have some of this trade dispute that's causing tariffs to increase the cost of some of their manufactured goods, and then that's cutting into their margins? Is that the big issue, or is it isolated to something else?
Well, no. Those are two of the underlying items, plus a couple more. They have lower margins to begin with, retail. This is not the healthcare industry. So they can't absorb a lot of additional costs. So any increase or change in the dollar costs them, because they usually can't pass it on. That's why a lot of them try to write in U.S. dollars. But if we get tariffs, that money has to be pushed on. They can't absorb it as much as, let's say, a chip maker, because they have a higher margin. So it's going to have to be passed on to the consumer. And that's what we've been hearing more and more from CEOs, that they have a concern going forward, if tariffs go in, how much is going to get pushed to consumer, and how it's going to hit their bottom line on there, both on the cost of the materials as well as any kind of production they have from there. So that's been a big part of the retail. Add to that the difficulty between brick and mortars and online, which has been reducing margins everywhere,
yeah,
as well as the items that stores are closing. I mean, there were reports that it was over about 5,000, almost 5,000 stores announcements this year to date, when you take out the ads and deletes. About 4,000. There was over 5,000 last year for the whole year. So we're probably going to beat that. So there's more store closings. And another area that we're looking at hasn't been impacted yet is some of the REITs that own the property for those stores.
That's really interesting because for a while we had all talked about the death of the mall, right? This whole idea of the mall.
And reinvention.
Right. And the reinvention, what they're going to do is they're going to make a mall without a roof. That was the reinvention. That was the big deal. I mean, seriously, if you look at what the hot thing is, it's the outdoor malls, the experience, because a lot of people don't want to just go to, when I was a kid, we used to go to the mall and just hang out. Maybe it was cold out. Maybe that's why. But all of a sudden, the big box retail mall is no longer a thing, right? And you see, you can go through some of these malls around the country and you could blow a cannon through there and nobody would get hurt.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden they come out with this reinvention where they're going to, put up a lot more of the same, but just without a roof, outside kind of, a lot of restaurants, a lot of high scale, high-end restaurants or better restaurants. And is that really going to save them?
Well, the actual malls themselves, a lot of them are repurposing themselves, actually, bringing in professionals. Professionals being, doctors, lawyers, dentists, items like that, and living centers next to it for the older people like myself who want to live near something. But the kind that you're talking about, the old what used to be called the strip malls, are a lot cheaper to make. You can lay them out easier. You don't have a set area usually on there. You don't have high maintenance on there, the structures. If you can just put an overhead, you can even get put it into the cold sections and still have a life in January and February,
right,
and during the holiday
yep.
season.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how much more of that can we absorb in the fight of brick and mortar, which it still is, versus the web?
Right, and then the REITs, we're talking about the REITs that are...
that own the properties
right.
on them, they rent them out, so typically they try to get several large clients you know, as a block in there, you know, for base, and then make more money on the smaller ones going in there. And those REITs, they've done well in trying to reinvent themselves, but there's still a lot of difficulties. Obviously, low interest rates go, but, you know, month-to-date, real estate, so far at least, is the only profitable sector we have here.
Right. Well, one of the things also about the REITs was that the old REITs, the old malls, there was a stipulation in a lot of the various deals that if you take this 20-year deal and you move out, too bad, you're still stuck with it. You guaranteed the deal. So I'm assuming that a lot of these companies got wise to this thing and said, you know what, we're not guaranteeing this as much anymore. And then there was also guarantees for some of the smaller companies in these malls, the old-fashioned malls, that if the anchor store left, you would be able to possibly get out of your deal. So, you know, these things were actually good for REITs because it held the feet to the fire for any of these companies that were moving out. But then, I'm assuming that a lot of these deals have been struck differently, whereas there's not as much, the companies are going to be saying, you know what, we're not going to get into these things where we're going to be able to just pay forever if things don't go well. We'll put on a time frame for it, or maybe even a cut rate if we move out, but there's going to be some kind of out here because we're not going to go bankrupt for the benefit of just renting this space.
Yeah, they definitely, you know, have a different approach on that. You know, they've got a big amount of expenditure to begin with. You know, we're talking from the store side,
yeah.
You know, to set up whatever the real estate agents want to put into there, you know, the REIT itself, the mall operator, you know, however the structure is for that. But they're trying to limit more. I mean, you look at the companies, for example, the old Sears and Alexander's, which a lot of people looked at.
Alexander's. I remember that one.
Well, they ended up being a real estate company. And lo and behold, their New York headquarters is now a building called Bloomberg.
Is that what was it? Alexander's, the one I used to go to was in Queens.
59th Street?
No, I went to one in Queens. That big, I went there every year.
Queens Boulevard?
Yeah, it was on Queens, right, exactly.
And, Queens Boulevard, yep. 63rd yep. Road, or 63rd Street, yeah. But the one in the city became Bloomberg, which is, of course, in Bloomingdale's, became
the Bloomberg.
Bloomberg.
So it's interesting, I used to go there every year at the start of the year to get all my school clothes.
You're a Queens guy.
That was the day we used to travel to do that. I have some questions about some trends and some changes and things. Remember, we had talked about this whole idea of non-GAAP versus GAAP reporting, and it was all of a sudden there's this upswell of non-GAAP for a while. I think it's resolved a bit more, and we're getting more towards GAAP reporting, aren't we?
They're getting close together because there's not as many items. The difference between operating GAAP, okay, first of all, the difficulty is obviously GAAP is defined by Financial Standard Accounting Board, which answers to SEC, which answers to Congress. They're set rules. Whether you do it, I do it, it's the same number to the 10th digit, unless there's fraud. Operating is not legally defined. It's what you explain it to be. I make widgets. It should be for my widgets. But every once in a while, companies change that. And during good times, the difference between the two is corporate expense. I have M&A. I have certain financing, layoffs, what things that would happen. But during difficult times, when markets drop for whatever reason, this difference between the two get bigger as companies, excuse the terminology, make excuses for why they didn't make it. A truck, such as a trucking company, keeps its trucks and after 7 years has to paint it. Well, that's a once-in-a-lifetime event, but you're a trucking company. That's an expense.
Yeah.
But we've seen it excluded. Companies that had their tax loss carry-forwards and ran out of that and said, well, we haven't had to pay taxes in 5 years, but so we're excluding that. So right now the difference has come down, but usually during the fourth quarter, if we looked at the fourth quarter, for example, of last year, it swells up when companies take those write-offs, once-a-year deals that the accounting society says you have to review each year and mark to market, you know, what that is worth, a patent or a right, whatever you have, or discounted cash flow, typically. So they have come together, but again, when times get bad, they grow significantly. So investors,
you know, it's funny about this. Howard, what's funny about this is that they have, companies have trained investors to believe that these one-time write-offs, these one-time charges, are something to ignore. In other words, it seems to me that whenever you see a one-time, you know, earnings are supposed to be this, they are this because we have a 15-cent one-time charge. It's a headline to ignore this number. And it seems to me that investors do a good job of listening to what they're supposed to be doing, is ignoring, which may not actually be the right thing to do.
No, it definitely should be. And they should look back to 2000, 2002, when it was known as everything but the bad stuff.
Right.
Companies excluded everything at that point. The operating is important because, again, they make widgets. This is what they make for it. But there's other expenses. So you need to keep an eye on that. Say, okay, this is good. And every once in a while you have something. I'm moving a plant. I'm doing something unusual. Okay, not extraordinary, but unusual that you do once in a while. I have a kid. I have to pay my tuition. My roof every once in a while needs to get fixed.
Right.
The air conditioning goes. That's part of the company, but it's not part of the operating. But you need to keep an eye on this. And when you start seeing things that are a little bit strange on there, well, this, you know, and investors have to say, to rationalize whether this is truly a one-time deal or not. Again, in the idea of the trucking company that was an actual case, I think you decide that you own the trucks, you got to paint them. That's part of the maintenance. Don't tell me it's once in a lifetime.
Right, exactly. We only have to paint once every 7 years, but it's once in a lifetime.
yeah, you know, I mean, and I had to pay the tuition.
Right.
And we had to fix the roof. That's part of it.
What other trends? I mean, currency weakness, you know, for a while, we also got that whole line of, we're going to look at the numbers, but we were being told to look at the numbers through the glass of, this is a currency adjusted number. That seems to happen when, you know, we either have weather is, of course, a great excuse, right?
Weather is always great, and it's actually a legitimate one for parts of the first quarter.
Right, weather. Then you also have currency, constant currency basis accounting. Now, I find that to be disingenuous, because when the currencies are a tailwind, we never hear about that.
Yeah, they cut both ways, shall we say.
Yeah, but they cut both ways, but they don't talk about them both ways.
Right. Some companies, again, write in U.S. dollars, but more importantly, what we hear about is usually within the retail. You hear it from companies like McDonald's, Tiffany's, companies that have a lot abroad, okay, and where a change in the dollar could quickly change who's buying what and where. And those happen, and by the way, those kind of companies usually give you the best information on currencies because it happens so quickly that they need to justify it and make a change. Oh, the pound sank because of, therefore, this is what happened on there. It can't really be predicted that well. Companies usually do not try to hedge. If they're manufacturers, they'll write it against U.S. dollars, something like a Caterpillar or something with heavy machinery. But it does take an impact on a higher impact on merchandise that can be quickly decided upon to buy or not. Am I going to the movies tonight? Am I going to McDonald's? Am I buying a suit? And if so, which store am I buying it in on there? So these things within the currencies make a big difference, and you hear a lot about them. So especially in things like retail, they can make an enormous difference right away. Slower impact, again, on manufacturing. Nobody's not ordering that tractor trailer because of a slight currency change. But over time, they might.
Right. What about buybacks? Let's get into this discussion because we've talked about this before. And this is kind of an area that is to me a little bit frustrating, because one of the things that I've talked to you about, as a matter of fact, was over the last number of years, we've seen companies really do a dramatic job at buying back their companies. As a matter of fact, I saw a couple of pieces recently that talked about the biggest buyers in the market over the last 10 years, by a significant margin, have been companies buying back their own stocks. You look at
enormous amount.
Enormous.
On this case, yeah, especially this year when, companies spent a lot more. Investors were pushing them to use all those tax savings. And I should say that while buybacks made a record, so did the fourth quarter capital expenditures, so did dividends. But buybacks are by far the favorite child here.
And we know why. It's not to sell people they're doing anything illegal, because they're not, but it's a bit of financial wizardry.
Buybacks and earnings should be a required MBA course, no doubt about it. The buybacks are on a short-term basis, all win-win situation. Okay, short-term. The minute I do it, I am buying additional stocks. I'm supporting my stock. Even if the stock's going down, I have more buyers. Similar to your house, you have four buyers. You're getting better than three buyers. Mm-hmm. It's the same house. So it supports the stock. Second thing, it negates any options that you may have put out there. So you're protecting your earnings. And if you do enough of it in a quarter, your share count goes down. Therefore, your EPS go up. And your PE looks more attractive. We have a measure that we use with companies on buybacks that we consider significant, where they start to impact the market. Okay, and for the first quarter, okay, one in four companies in the S&P 500, 25.16%, but one in four companies in the 500 increased their EPS by a minimum of 4%.
Wow.
Due to buybacks.
Wow.
That's a minimum. That 25.16% compares to last year, the first quarter of 18, of 13.6. That's a lot. And investors really need, as we've discussed, to look at how a company is growing, because you do not want to pay the same PE for, as you call it, adjusting and do buybacks, growing your numbers through math, as you do for growing your sales and your margins and your actual business operations. So, and the companies, compared to 2000, 2002, are really upfront about it. You look right in the income statement, and you'll see net income, millions of dollars went up 10%, EPS went up 16%. And those are two numbers you really have to go, because you do not want to overpay and pay the same premium for buybacks as you do for sales.
Now, one of the things I've asked you about before, and I'm going to ask you about again, and I know there was an answer we kind of went around, but I have never seen a clean buyback adjusted EPS on a company basis. Am I missing something? Why is this not a data point that's put out?
It's not required. I mean, the best would be to use the net income. The company shares that they use are also an average of the last 3 months, month end number. So you really have to go in and start playing with it to get that, and have all kinds of questions on there. On an individual basis, though, you can just simply use the share count that they're using. That's, for example, those 25% that I said, which have at least a 4% reduction. So that's one way you can look at it. But to get an adjusted basis is going to be a lot more difficult. You're not going to get the information. It also gets a little bit more complex with how many options I did. What was my net amount in there as compared to options being paid in, cash flow going out. But you're not going to find that number too easy.
But can't you put out this number, and very simply, tell me if this is just too simplistic, that you look at earnings per share. So let's just say 10 cents for the quarter, just a number, okay? Or just look at the earnings, earnings divided by the shares, but keep a constant earnings number, net earnings number, and just divide it by what the share count would have been over time. Can't you do that?
We read all the headlines with buybacks, okay, and the share reduction. Companies also add shares. They add them for options. They add it for M&A work. They add it for compensation. So there's a lot of other items in there. Buybacks, while they affect the share count, M&A affects it a lot more. And distributions, which were so popular a couple of years ago when stocks, were splitting into different units and everything, affects it a lot more. So the buybacks have an impact on there and the share count, but there's a lot of other factors that come in there. Definitely buybacks have grown in importance, but they are still not the biggest impact on the share count. M&A remains that.
But still, a 4% increase. Come on, let's be honest here. A 4% increase
minimum
in EPS on a quarter, on a year-over-year basis, in other words, for the quarter, this quarter right. versus a quarter year ago, especially with the fact that you had a significant increase due to tax benefits a year ago. I mean, if there was, let's say this, I think we probably agree to this. If there was no buybacks, if there was no buybacks at all this quarter, probably earnings would have not have looked as good.
The well, two answers to that. On issue level, definitely not. And we could use this 25% just to look at those companies and say, those automatically have 4% less right off the top on there. You know, how much did Apple's $23 billion impact? A lot. On an index basis, it doesn't, because we adjust and use millions of dollars. You can buy back every share except for one, and it doesn't make a difference on our side because of the math. But yes, there's a lot of companies out there, and it is a big part. And they're somewhat upfront about it, because buybacks today are something that you boast about. A company comes out and makes a big announcement, I'm increasing my buyback program to such and such, giving, let's say, guidance over the next couple of quarters or a year. That stock typically goes up.
Well, of course, they can control some of the outlook.
They can control some of the earnings per share.
Yeah, which is what everybody looks at.
Their, right, it cannot impact their business cycle. It does right. not impact, you know, their actual sales on there, but it's definitely the EPS. And, you know, that's why we picked, you know, this 4%. We believe that's a significant area. We did some testing. It came out to about 3.7 and change percent. So we use 4%. And again, it is something companies are very conscious of, and investors need to be as well, because it changes that PE. Again, just an easy example, a company made $1 million last year, $1 million this year. Well, they reduced their share count by that 4%. All of a sudden, the dollar EPS goes up to $1.04. But you have the same $1 million in your pocket.
Yeah, and the company then does a multiple of their PE and gets a higher value
that's
of the stock and more buying, because you have the company buying it as well, holding up the stock. So you got this double whammy. And so you got to question whether a, you know, when a lot of times you see these pundits on TV talking about, well, the average PE over time has been 17 on a forward basis and, you know, maybe 18 on a look back basis, or whatever the exact number is. And they start looking at where we are today. You have to wonder, well, does that really qualify for the same numbers?
Depending upon how far back you go, no.
I agree.
Obviously, you know, right. we're at about, you know, using the March 12-month March, we're about 18.4, which is still on the high side historically. But it wasn't too long ago, 2016, 2017, we were in the 20 range, you know, 21.
This is on trailing, right?
Actual trailing,
yeah,
right?
Trailing, yeah.
You know, we can go forward, but I'm just saying, just on the trail. Mm-hmm. And the talk on the street was, you know, is, you know, the 20 the new 16?
Yeah. Once that talk starts happening, I get nervous.
Well, then you should have been nervous. Yeah. There's not much of that talk around now, but
yeah.
The 18 still gets a lot. You know, the 18.4 still gets people nervous, and it's a strong number. Even going into 2019, we have 17.1. You know, you drop down to the 15.2 level for 2020, but 2020 is a long way
yeah,
off.
It sure is.
I need to get through this quarter first.
So we're talking about equities here. Let's talk about. I've never really talked to you about this, but I want to know your thoughts on this, debt ratios. And
debt,
what's going on with corporate
ratios,
debt?
Yeah. Well, to answer, let me just throw in, since we hit a 222 today on the 10-year, how low we are, you know, since September 2017. You know, global numbers, it's gone.
It's gone.
So many countries are negative. You're not getting a toaster. You've got to give a toaster to get when you make your deposit now. Bottom line is that interest rates are low, money is plentiful, and companies can get it. There's two parts of the debt, and again, I'm not a bond person on here, but from an equity point of view, what it costs me and how am I leveraging? On a cost basis, interest expense has gone up. over the last several years, but so is interest rates, even at the current level, okay? But it's still significantly less than it was several years ago on a cost basis. So companies have a strong underlying balance sheet. They've got good cash flow that is covering the interest expense, okay? And most of them that could have, at least within the 500, of course, they refinance the same way you would your mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
So their debt is pretty good. The ones that are borrowing money for buybacks basically are usually doing it because money is cheap and the accountants are telling them to do it as compared to they don't have it. That said, all debt is real. And the debt within big caps has gone up. Not to the early 2000 levels, you know, using ratios, but it's gone up and it's real debt. Even if you use it and you have cash sitting on the side, you know, good assets and good coverage, it's still good debt, and it's real. So you do have to have concerns about that companies, you know, overextending themselves. So the main question is, what are you doing with the with that debt? If you're doing it for buybacks, I mean, if you talk to a bond person, they hate it. It does nothing to enhance the timely repayment of principal interest. You talk to an equity person, we love it. And borrow all you can, support that stock on there. So it's what they're doing. Again, the overall numbers have increased, but the ratios are still good on there.
The ratio is good, but the raw number is the highest level of corporate debt ever.
Yes, but they've also got the highest cash.
Yeah.
You look at the industrial as an example. They have $1.4 trillion in cash. That's a preliminary number for the first quarter.
So wait, the industrials have how much? How much do the industrials have?
About 1.39.
1.39, and about $250 billion of that is Apple.
No, about 80 is Apple. Apple is the only one that does it this way. If you look at the Apple, and they're up front on it, we count the cash, $1.4 trillion is in the current asset.
The current asset, I got you.
Okay, that they can go and take it. Apple has investments, and they put it in investments, which is after that. That's in their assets, but it's longer term. But when you look at the footnotes in there, most of it is marked to market, level one or two. There's no mark to make believe in there. And they are marketable securities that they can literally almost, you know, pick up the phone and, you know, and give the high side to the trader and get the cash right there. But they put it out on the other side. So that money is not counted in the $1.4 trillion that I quoted.
I got you.
And they're unique in the way they do it. But then again, no one has that kind of money outside of a couple of countries.
They get to do what they want. They get to do what they want. I appreciate that. This is awesome. I mean, is there any other like trends that you see? I mean, this big talk about factor investing these days and this, you know, value versus growth and how value has been just absolutely pummeled for the longest time. And
shorter or longer term?
Both? Medium.
Both. Okay. Shorter term, everyone's concerned about, you know, June is being called the renegotiated month. I mean, a lot of things are going to happen that are going to decide a lot of the market and the allocations that going forward. I mean, you had obviously the BRICS, that you had this the G20 meeting coming up there with the whole U.S.-China situation. You've got several congressional committees coming in, subpoenas and all those items in there. So there's a lot going on short term, okay? And a lot of the money managers have their plans for which way it goes. We do have a slight down tick in the market now, I mean today as well, but we're still only about 5.7% off the high, okay? Halfway to a correction, yes, but not a bad market considering all the nervousness and talk and the evaluation of what tariffs and trades are. So short-term tariffs and trades are a major issue that are going to impact the market at this point. Longer term, obviously, outside of that, you know, it's the change in the economy, the change in how much more maybe web-based, for example, on retail, the demographics of infrastructure. You know, will that $2 trillion plan that supposedly Democrats and Republicans want, although they want to finance it totally different, ever come true, which is going to be all domestic spending, you know, which will really be a shot in the arm on here, both on unemployment as well. I'm not sure how you manufacture some of those things.
Well, paying is the big issue.
Right, whether you're using MMT or whether you're, you know, increasing the debt or you're reallocating, is it a pay-as-you-go, is it a debt? You know, that's a major item. You know, but longer term, those are some of the things on there. But the short-term trade and tariff situation is really guiding the market. I mean, this whole 5.7% decline with that is since the reevaluation, since that, you know, May 3rd, that weekend on there. And it's still playing out. The street is still looking at it. More money managers are looking at it than it's negotiations. But there's a very big growing, and it's growing quickly, of people saying, no, this is taking on a life of its own. Too much is being said publicly, and it's hard to pull back when you make public statements.
Well, one of the things that I'll tell you this, because I haven't talked to you about this, but one of my theories on this is I've been very concerned about this for a while. And fortunately, I was pretty concerned about it last year. So that allowed us to kind of take a little bit off the table on some of this and not get smacked so hard by what went on at the end of last year, and then kind of ride up some of this this year. But here's the thing. So if anybody's been to Asia and understands the Asian culture, I'm talking specifically about China right now, they're very proud people. They don't want to be, they've been historically conquered. They will not ever in any way, shape, or form be allow themselves to be conquered in any facet of the world, you know, whether it's actual, you know, taking over their space, their islands, or even in finance, in financial markets. That's number one. Number two, I think this is the big issue here. This is President Trump versus President Xi. The difference is startling on a political standpoint because of one basic issue. And that is President Trump has 4 years and then a potential new 4 years where he has to campaign and get things done. In China last year, they changed the constitution, or let's call it the constitution. No, it's not really a constitution, but they changed their rules. That President Xi is in there for life now. He has no problem because he doesn't have to worry about expending political capital. So he could let this go as long as he wants. And he doesn't have any problem there, where President Trump does. Now, his economy may get crushed, and he doesn't want that to happen. But you know China. They've been through this stuff. You know, they'll go up, they'll go down, they'll push more into the banks, they'll push more into the economy, they'll build ghost cities. They'll do some crazy stuff over there to keep the economy going. I just think that's a big problem that people are overlooking about this quote-unquote negotiation process.
I think that to some degree, some of that's understood and accepted in the fact that the U.S. appears to a lot of people to be more short-term oriented and China more long-term oriented. Also, the regulations are different. The ability, when Apple had a problem, remember, with their screen, basically the leadership there stood up, blew the whistle, and over 120,000 people literally moved over, and now you're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Try doing that. You know, I don't think they had a problem with the U.S. EPA on changing the plan.
Right.
And I'm not trying to make a political statement one way or another. You know, it's just different processes and different approaches, and as you pointed out on there, and different objectives. And, you know, exactly. To some degree, U.S. is shorter term, as you pointed out there, and they're longer term. You know, the question is, just like when you asked on investing, short-term, long-term, two different items.
Yep, exactly. Well, we're going to wrap it up here. Howard Silverblatt from S&P Dow Jones Indices. Always great to have you, and we'll do it again soon. Appreciate it.
No problem. You take care.
All right, have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Great stuff from Howard Silverblatt. Always great because, like I said, he's a keeper of the information when it comes to the S&P Dow Jones Indices. So might as well get the information right from the horse's mouth, so to speak. We're going to end it up right here, folks. Like I said earlier, of course, you can check out all that we have over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes of this episode, plus the various strategies that we run. Also, I want to make sure, really, if you haven't done so, first of all, you can follow the weekly pre-market rundown over on the Trigger Charts YouTube channel under the webinars, or you can come live 9 o'clock in the morning on Fridays. Just go over to trickacharts.com and sign up, or you can register over at the Discipline Investor. There's a link somewhere there in the show notes that will get you right to where you want to be. Kind of a cool video / screen share informational sharing discussion that we have on Fridays. So do that. Let me know if you have any questions, of course. You can go over to disciplineinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button, and send me your question, and I will either put it on the air. We have a few that are grouping up over here for probably next week's discussion, and or I will kind of give you some thoughts direct from email. Thanks for joining me. I hope you have a great week. Let's start June on a better note here, folks. But generally speaking, like I said, time to probably be a little cautious into this unknown world of tariff domination, as I'm calling it right now. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.